Mr. Winberg, good morning to you, and Ms. West, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions?
No.
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Winberg, you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Winberg. I'm a deputy county attorney here on behalf of Douglas County and the state of Nebraska. The short facts of this case: on October 11th, 2020, Alicia Lewis was operating a motor vehicle at a high rate of speed and under the influence of alcohol. She caused a motor vehicle collision in which her passenger, Thomas Martin, sustained critical head injuries. She was initially charged with DUI causing serious bodily injury. She pled guilty to that charge and was sentenced on that charge on March 22nd of 2021 in the Douglas County District Court. Thomas Martin was still alive at that time. He died on June 17, 2021 from injuries sustained in that collision, and the state subsequently charged Mylesha Lewis with motor vehicle homicide DUI on December 20 of 2021. The state is appealing the plea in bar here. When looking at the three assignments of error under the traditional Blockberger test, the same elements test, we would look at did one of these offenses have a different element here? I think the obvious different element of motor vehicle homicide, DUI, would be death. I think also neither offense is a lesser included offense of the other. And we have subdivision 4 that was added to both statutes in 2011 that indicate they shall be treated as separate and distinct offenses from any other offense. Now, based on this, I do think successive prosecution is warranted based on these statutes themselves and Nebraska and Supreme Court case law. That first assignment of error under Blockberger, again, I think it's pretty straightforward. It lays out a same elements test for this court, looking at if either of the statutes do not contain a different element, then they'd be considered the same offense, and double jeopardy would bar additional punishment. Again, the obvious different element would be death.
Can you cause a DUI causing serious bodily injury? Can you cause manslaughter without causing the DUI serious bodily injury?
Sure, I think a defendant could be charged with manslaughter under a theory of reckless driving that may involve not drunkenness at all, but high speed, running red lights.
Well, but the serious bodily injury kind of leads to the death, doesn't it?
Is the question, could we have charged this defendant with manslaughter?
No, I mean, are they the same elements?
Manslaughter and motor vehicle.
Can you have a death without a serious bodily injury?
Yes, I think you have cases where you have instantaneous death, right? So you have a pedestrian that's struck by a car going 100 miles an hour.
But isn't that instantaneous death due to serious bodily injury?
That's what causes the death, right?
I guess the way I would look at it is that it's not always going to be serious bodily injury and death. You're not going to have testimony that would say this person was injured. You're going to have testimony from a coroner that says they died upon impact or a high-speed motor vehicle collision.
Blood force trauma or...
Right, that there'd be immediate death. They would, we have cases where...
A statutory definition. Serious bodily injury.
Yes, I think the DUI statute defines it in there. Yeah, it talks about the protracted loss or function of any part or organ of the body that goes through and does those things, and not included in there is death, right?
There's substantial risk of death.
Sure, but I think those
Can you have a death without substantial risk of death?
I mean, I think you could have instantaneous death that'd be different, right? That you may have...
But isn't there a substantial risk of death in the case of instantaneous death?
I think you just have death, right? I think there are some cases where people may be injured. They're treated, whether it's by medics or the hospital for a period
it may be
of time.
It may be a very short period of time, but isn't there a substantial risk of death during that short period of time?
If not,
how else does the death occur?
I think there's just a distinction, right? There's cases where you may have instantaneous death, and there's cases where someone may survive for a period of time. Here we're looking at 9 months and a long period of time between an initial collision and death. And I think if you're looking at, are those the same? I don't think they are, but you also have subdivision 4 that lays out, these are to be treated as separate and distinct.
What does subdivision
4 mean? The way I take it is it looked at some of this court's decisions in Huff 1, and where the court's looking at manslaughter and motor vehicle homicide and saying that those should be treated as, lesser included offense, and is saying that the legislature sought a change there, that the motor vehicle homicide DUI should be treated as separate and distinct. Which that's added to there in subdivision 4, and that was also added into the DUI serious bodily injury statute. And so I think when you look at the analysis here, you have to also look at, we go through the case law, how has the U.S. Supreme Court looked at scenarios like this, where we have an initial injury, period of time, and then a subsequent death. I outline that in the brief, but I think what you see there is Diaz is that 1912 case where you have an initial assault, a person is prosecuted for simple assault, the victim dies about a month later, and then that defendant was subsequently charged with homicide. The Supreme Court held that those were different offenses or distinct offenses in law and in fact.
Isn't that because the first was the lesser included of the successive prosecution?
Sure, and I think that's...
And to rely on that, doesn't the state have to concede that DUI causing serious bodily injury is a lesser included offense of motor vehicle homicide?
I mean, DUI? I think that's a closer question, right? I think Blockberger...
Well, don't you have to take inconsistent positions to rely on Diaz?
No, I mean, I think Diaz is talking about those two specific statutes, right? Or the two specific offenses and finding that...
Or at least alternative positions?
I wouldn't say they're alternative. I'm saying I think the Blockberger is a no. Whether it's a lesser included is a closer distinction when you look at the elements, right? Because serious bodily injury, there's case law that talks about that. But I think when you look at subdivision 4, it's telling the courts to treat them differently, to not necessarily treat them as a lesser included offense. So, I mean, I think if a court, you can deny Blockberger, you can make a finding that it is a lesser included offense, but subdivision 4 changes that analysis. And then I certainly still think you are able to look at Diaz and then the successive analysis in Jeffers v. United States that went through and talked about what are some of the exceptions if there is a lesser included crime and a greater included crime.
This may be going in reverse order, and then I'll expose my ignorance, but could you have a charge where someone dies in the accident, but the driver is charged with DUI, serious bodily injury?
I mean, I certainly, as a prosecutor, I wouldn't do that. I would charge the greatest available charge I thought was supported by the evidence.
So would it have been a viable charge?
I guess if someone is injured for a period of time, yeah, you could charge that as opposed to the motor vehicle homicide or a manslaughter.
So we're back to passage of time.
Sure, and that may be the charge you start with if the person is not deceased, as was the case here.
I'm positing an injury, a period of time, a death, and thereafter a charge limited to DUI serious bodily injury, notwithstanding a death.
Sure, I think one could only charge that if that was what the prosecutor's office saw fit. I know if it was my case, I would proceed.
And then where would that get you for any subsequent prosecutions based on death?
That's a good point. I think that's very different when it talks about, is there prosecutorial overreach? So let's say I knew in your scenario that the person was dead, but I chose not to amend the charge.
We're undercharging. So
right. I think then you could look at that on appeal and say the prosecutor had the opportunity, all the facts were known at the time, and they chose not to pursue the greater charge there. I think the state should be barred from then trying to do a subsequent prosecution.
But what's the statutory basis for that?
For the court to say that?
To make the argument based in statute.
I think it's not in the statute. It'd be in the Supreme Court case law in Jeffers, and then going forward in Garrett, they talked about successive prosecution on a greater offense will be warranted if it's justified by the public interest in law enforcement and a lack of prosecutorial overreaching. Here, I don't think there is prosecutorial overreach. We prosecuted it based on the way it came through to the office. We prosecuted it until we couldn't charge a motor vehicle homicide while the victim is still alive.
Is there a policy decision in charging the DUI causing serious bodily injury before you know whether the victim's going to die?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think if the court sustains this ruling, then you're leaving the state in a position, let's say there's a shooting where multiple people are in the hospital. We don't know if they're going to live or die. Do we wait to arrest somebody? Do we wait to charge them? I think the public policy there is no. We would want to charge that person.
What did the district court judge say about that?
We didn't really get into a deep policy analysis in the district court. I think Judge Battalion, in his ruling, thought that this violated Blockberger and thought it was double jeopardy and didn't really get into that. But I think that's a point you have to look at, and I think that's why you see those decisions in Jeffers and Garrett saying there is a very strong public policy interest in limited circumstances to allow successive prosecutions.
Did the district court's order address Diaz?
No.
Did you argue it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It was in our brief. We argued Diaz. We argued subsection 4. The district court didn't address subsection 4 as well. Ultimately, I think when you look at the case law, the facts of this case, I don't believe this is an instance of prosecutorial overreach. And I think allowing a successive prosecution would very much be consistent with Garrett, with Jeffers, with Diaz. And also when you look at that subdivision 4 in the analysis, think that also supports that.
Counsel, if a successive prosecution is allowed and a conviction occurs, is there still a double jeopardy issue with respect to sentencing? Does that still hanging out there?
I would say no. If she's convicted on a separate charge of motor vehicle homicide, no.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. West, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jessica West, and I represent the appellee, Malisha Lewis. This court should affirm the lower court's ruling because the district court properly applied Blockberger and Whalen analysis to the elements of the case as well as the facts and legal theories presented by the state. Double jeopardy prevents successive prosecution in this case. There are only two elements involved in both of these crimes. One is operating a motor vehicle under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and the other one is proximate causation. Now, the appellant's argument regarding the Blockberger and assignment of error for the district court is a forked tongue argument. On the one hand, they make the argument that the district court erred in not applying a strict same elements test, but at the same time, it was appellant who invited the district court to do a factual analysis under Whalen, because the state is arguing that they wouldn't necessarily need to prove serious bodily injury to prove death. Of course, that the district court did a factual analysis and determined through Blockberger, as outlined through Whalen with the factual analysis, that because the state pronounced their legal theory in this case was in fact to show that serious bodily injury did result in Mr. Martin's death, that Blockberger applies and double jeopardy prevents successive prosecution.
Under the definition, the statutory definition of serious bodily injury, there are sort of three lanes, right? Three different ways to prove serious bodily injury under the statute. Is that correct?
Yes.
And at the plea hearing, in this case, the factual basis that was provided by the state sort of checked all three boxes, didn't it?
For serious bodily injury?
Correct.
Yes.
Not just serious bodily injury causing, you know, likelihood of death.
Yes.
It was really checked all the boxes. How does that impact our elements analysis?
So the Nebraska Revised Statute 28109, subsection 21, defines serious bodily injury to include substantial risk of death.
And what else?
So there would be no different fact of proof that's required to show death in a motor vehicle homicide wherein the death has occurred. It merely obviates the substantial risk thereof.
So substantial risk of death, comma, a substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement, comma, or a temporary or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any part of the organ of the body. Right?
Yes.
So at the plea hearing, did the factual basis include all three of those, basically?
At the plea hearing, the defendant did enter a plea to the general crime of DUI serious bodily injury. And the factual basis included the fact that I think what you're asking is whether or not the state knew that there was a substantial risk of death at the time of the
whether that was the only theory or whether the factual basis included the other theories of proving serious bodily injury. I just didn't ask my question very well.
That's okay. No, at the time of the plea hearing, it was known to the state that Mr. Martin would eventually succumb from his injuries. They didn't know when. But they did know that that was eventually happening. And
did,
so I
did
think,
the plea hearing recite that Mr. Martin suffered permanent disfigurement to his skull? And did it also recite that he suffered impairment to the function of his brain? Was that part of the factual basis?
That was part of the factual
Thank
basis.
Thank you.
I think the question, though, is part of the question is whether or not the state has an obligation to wait and see what happens. And as the court noted, and as appellant had to concede, they have no statutory or legal basis to take their position that they don't have an obligation to wait and see.
So this is getting to your argument that Diaz doesn't apply?
Correct.
Okay.
And Diaz doesn't apply for a variety of reasons. Primarily, appellant miscites the holding in Diaz. The holding in Diaz turned on a jurisdictional issue, not on a factual issue. So what Diaz involved was the defendant entered a plea the day of the assault to a misdemeanor assault and battery, and the court that he pled in front of would not have jurisdiction over a homicide.
That wasn't the only reason discussed, though.
Part of what was discussed in the case was in dicta regarding that factual element, the fact that the victim eventually died from his injuries. But what's noted in that case is that part of what it turned on is that the state required an autopsy to find out if the person did in fact die from those injuries. That is distinguishable from the present case. The state knew that these substantial, that these serious bodily injuries would eventually result in Mr. Martin's death at the time that she entered the plea, at the plea hearing. And there are multiple, the appellant.
What evidence is there that they knew that?
There's no difference in the facts that were provided at the plea for the DUI serious bodily injury and the time that that they filed the charges at the plea and bar hearing.
Well, there's one pretty big difference, isn't there?
No, because under the Blockberger analysis, every fact was known to the state.
But the victim had actually died by the time the second charges were filed, correct?
But the state knew and was still within the statutory period of limitations, that there was a substantial risk of death from those injuries. So the state does have an obligation to wait and see. The argument that appellant
made... What authority is there that the state has an obligation to wait and see?
Because the state has powers granted to it, both statutory and constitutional,
right, I'm asking for, if you have authority to support that proposition.
Appellant does not have authority to cite that they don't have an obligation to wait and see. They make a policy argument. Appellee has authority in the sense that there's a lengthy 3-year statute of limitations. Mr. Martin died only 8 months into that statutory period of limitations. They have, there's case law where establishing that the state at any time for any reason can dismiss a criminal proceeding against the defendant. They have notice requirements for the plea hearing. They had several weeks and notice at the time of the plea for the sentencing hearing. They could have dismissed prior to her entering her plea. They could have dismissed prior to the court imposing a sentence in the case, and then later refiled the charges within that statutory period of limitations. What the court needs
is it your position that it would have been different here if the death would have been a surprise? If the deceased had injuries that people could not have seen, but then ultimately died later.
Yes.
That would be a different situation than we have here.
Yes, because the state has an obligation to do due diligence. And we see the delay in filing of charges all of the time. There needs to be more investigation. We're waiting on DNA results to come back. We're waiting for gunshot residue results to come back. We're subpoenaing cell phone records. We're subpoenaing medical records. We're waiting for more medical records to come through. There are all sorts of due diligence that the state is required to do in order to decide whether to and when to file
charges. Well, that's deciding if you have enough evidence to support the charge, which prosecutors have an ethical duty to do. But in this case, there was sufficient evidence to support a charge, correct?
Yes.
And they filed the charge, client pled guilty. And the new facts occur. What's the effect of that new fact? The death.
That is true, but that was still within the statutory period of limitations, and everything regarding the substantial risk of that higher charge coming forward was known to the prosecution at the time.
Well, you don't know that this person's going to die from this injury. There's no way to know that. That's impossible. They could have thrown a clot. The hospital could have been hit by a tornado. There could have been 1,000 reasons why this person died beyond the facts of the accident. So you can't say that they knew that. That's not possible. During this period of time, if they don't charge, then your client is free to continue on with her life. Is that correct? No bond, no charge, no incarceration, anything of that nature. Is that correct?
That's correct.
any risk to the public at that point?
That's a policy issue that this court doesn't need to engage in, because that's an executive branch function where they need to decide whether or not to proceed immediately on lesser charges and not wait and see and wait for more evidence and wait for more medical records, or if they want to wait for that and then impose a higher penalty. But in this case...
I beg your pardon, is that not a policy decision?
That's a policy decision for the executive branch to decide. And all that this court needs to do is point to the powers that the executive branch has, statute of limitations, case law ability to dismiss at any time for any reason, in order to say that that's an executive function and they need to make that decision on themselves.
The prosecutor is obliged, as Justice Funk indicated, to bring those charges which, in colloquial terms, they believe they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
That is true, but they also have due diligence obligation, and in this case, it's the appellee's position that their due diligence, that they did not do their due diligence in this case because there was a substantial risk of death, and all the facts were known to the prosecution at the time that they proceeded on the serious bodily injury, that Mr. Martin was likely to succumb to his injuries at some point in time.
Chief, may I ask an additional question?
You may.
Before you sit down, you were talking a little bit ago about, you were starting to distinguish Diaz, and I think we threw some additional questions at you, and I'm not sure you ever finished that answer. And before you sit down, I want to be sure I understand what your best argument is, that Diaz and its progeny don't apply here.
Primarily that case happened prior to Blockberger and Whalen. And
but it's been cited by the Supreme Court and other state appellate courts since then.
Yes, but that was a jurisdictional issue.
That's your strongest argument.
Yes.
Thank you.
One last question before you sit down. If, hypothetically speaking, if this court disagrees with you and a successful second prosecution does occur, will there be additional double jeopardy issues arise when the sentencing is considered?
Yes, and I do think that that's an important distinction to make. When the appellant cites Jeffers and Garrett, what happened in those cases is that the court decided that the defendant had waived their right for a double jeopardy claim because they had requested the severance of trial in those cases. And they, in both cases, decided that the double jeopardy claim was going to come at the end to determine if that person was convicted of both of the charges, then only one punishment could be imposed because double jeopardy would prevent successive punishments in those cases. So while the defendant waived the right to have his double jeopardy claim regarding successive prosecutions, he did not yet waive his right against not have successive punishments. And so that is certainly something that the court needs to understand, that there's a difference in those Jeffers and Garrett case from the present case in making its decision.
But you would agree that that issue would not yet be ripe to be taken up right now?
Correct.
With regard to sentencing?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
13 seconds, Your Honor.
13 seconds. Mr. Winberg.
Thank you. The 2 points I would briefly make would be the risk of death and death are very much not the same thing. One cannot still be alive and dead. Those are different things. And the second, there's nothing in the record to suggest the state knew this victim was going to die.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State versus Lewis. Counsel, you are excused. And again, thank you. And the next case of the day then is Partouche versus Partouche.